So the reading this morning is just one from the Gospel of Mark in chapter 5, verses 21 through 43. Let us listen for God's word. When Jesus had crossed again in the boat to the other side, a great crowd gathered around him, and he was by the sea. Then one of the leaders of the synagogue named Jairus came, and when he saw him, fell at his feet and begged him repeatedly, "My little daughter is at the point of death. Come and lay your hands on her so that she may be made well and live." So he went with him, and a large crowd followed him and pressed in on him. Now there was a woman who had been suffering from hemorrhages for 12 years. She had endured much under many physicians and had spent all that she had, and she was no better, but rather grew worse. She had heard about Jesus and came up behind him in the crowd and touched his cloak, for she said, "If I but touch his clothes, I will be made well." Immediately her hemorrhage stopped, and she felt in her body that she was healed of her disease. Immediately aware that power had gone forth from him, Jesus turned about in the crowd and said, "Who touched my clothes?" And his disciples said to him, "You see the crowd pressing in on you. How can you say, 'Who touched me?'" He looked all around to see who had done it. But the woman, knowing what had happened to her, came in fear and trembling, fell down before him and told him the whole truth. He said to her, "Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your disease." While he was still speaking, some people came from the leader's house to say, "Your daughter is dead. Why trouble the teacher any further?" But overhearing what they said, Jesus said to the leader of the synagogue, "Do not fear, only believe." He allowed no one to follow him except Peter, James, and John, the brother of James. When they came to the house of the leader of the synagogue, he saw a commotion, people weeping and wailing loudly. When he had entered, he said to them, "Why do you make a commotion and weep? The child is not dead, but sleeping." And they laughed at him. Then he put them all outside and took the child's father and mother and those who were with him and went in where the child was. He took her by the hand and said to her, "Talitha cum," which means, "Little girl, get up." And immediately the girl got up and began to walk about. She was 12 years of age. At this, they were overcome with amazement. He strictly ordered them that no one should know this and told them to give her something to eat. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. So I have to confess, and I probably made this confession before, I've been around here for a while, that I find it difficult to preach on Jesus's healing stories. I'm aware of people who have prayed for healing and have been healed. I'm also aware of people who have prayed for healing and who have not. And then, you know, you kind of watch how people react. And sometimes it is voice, sometimes it is not. But we are always tempted to categorize our experiences of life, to place them into some kind of mental framework of understanding and explanation. It makes us feel more comfortable. And so the temptation is to say, this person or these people really had faith, and that's why they were healed. And by the same token, to say, well, this person or these people didn't really have faith, and that's why they were not. And so I always get a little queasy when people push conclusions about faith too hard, because it just simply doesn't seem to measure up to what I've experienced in dealing with people over the years. And also, there's just this reality that when people are sick, seriously ill, they're in a very vulnerable state, emotionally and spiritually. And I think I've just internalized the Hippocratic Oath, which says, first off, do no harm. And as a minister, I don't want to harm anyone by giving them some kind of false hope or by manipulating their vulnerability. And so I think back to my own family experience. And if you'll allow me, I'm going to use that as a way of reflecting about these passages some. And I remember when my mother got a terminal diagnosis of cancer. The cancer had metastasized in the liver. And so I was in New Jersey, mom and dad in Tennessee, and I went home for a long weekend to be with them and my siblings. And we went to the doctor's office, several of us. And I was so impressed with the way he communicated with us. And he said, you know, as a doctor, I have to tell you what the statistics tell me. And what they tell me is that you have about a year and a half to live. And he says, but also I know who you are. I know that you're people of faith. And he says, I have to tell you, too, that there are exceptions to the rule. And you, too, might be an exception. Pray that you'll be an exception. Pray for a miracle. But at the same time, understand, you know, the gravity of what I'm telling you about your situation. Don't hold any sort of false hope. And what I sense there is just, there was just this real integrity and humanity about his communication. And so that there was a bringing together of this polarity of you, if you will, this polarity of an impending death, but also of the possibility of healing. And, you know, what we tend to do with our consciousness is we split polarities right into binaries, and the two can't belong together. But in a certain way of thinking and viewing reality, polarities form a complete whole. Do you know what I mean? It's like the yin and the yang. It's the day and the night. They are opposites, but they are also part of a greater whole. And I think the eyes of faith are inviting us to see our reality in that more holistic way. As it turned out, my mother was not an exception. She died, and it was just about a year and a half after the diagnosis came. But her death became something of a faith crisis for her faith community, who believed that God had told them and my mother that she was going to live. And I compare that to my experience of when I, you know, went home for a long weekend, and we were processing this news as a family together, and how incredibly intimate and beautiful and loving the conversation was. You know, all the things that we feel, but in the course of our ordinary existence, just don't bother to communicate to each other how much we love each other. You know, just how much they mean to us. And those were the kinds of conversations we were having all weekend. And in some ways, it was just so beautiful and graceful and ironically, even life-giving, as we were leaning into the reality of my mother's mortality. But then what happened in the weeks that followed is, again, my mom and my dad and their small church became convinced that mom was not going to die. And all of a sudden, any other possibility was off the table for conversation. All we could talk about was, isn't it great that mom is going to be delivered? And I felt such a sadness in the loss of intimacy that happened in that stance. And I compare this also to the experience of my kid brother, Jared, in his fight with cancer, really that overlapped my mother's. He fought for 6 years and underwent some really severe treatments. And when it became clear to him, that he was not going to make it, that he was going to die at the tender age of 26, there ironically was within him a deepening of presence and awareness, and dare I say it, grace, which made his death beautiful, even as it broke our hearts. And I guess what I'm trying to say before I jump into the deep waters of the biblical text that I read is that the circumstances of our lives are part of an immense interconnected whole that we see only a very small sliver of. And we're convinced, you know, that we know what we want, that we know what we need, that we know what is the best outcome, when the truth of the matter is we see such a small part of the context that we live in. And only a small part of it is visible. Much of it is invisible, and it takes the perception of faith and trust to begin to understand. And so I think the practice for us always is to cry out to God for help, to cry out for the outcome that we want, to cry out that, God, you know what I want. God knows what our hearts want. But sometimes we need clarity about what we really want. And to make that known as honestly and as zealously as we can, and to allow God to, because God is always moving towards us in a posture of grace and mercy, but to allow God to speak in ways that perhaps we don't expect and perhaps we can't even begin at this moment to understand. Certainly Jesus is consistent, absolutely consistent in the Gospels of being impressed by and encouraging of faith. Daughter, your faith has made you well, he said to this woman as she touched his cloak. And he said that time and time again in the Gospels, your faith has made you well. And he told Jairus, once Jairus, the synagogue leader, gets this news that, you know, why bother? Your daughter is dead. Jesus said, don't be afraid. Just believe. Just believe. So I'm going to go out on a limb and say that keeping an open and positive and trusting heart, what the Gospels call faith, is somehow essential to our ability to experience God's healing us in difficult circumstances. And of course, this is not easy. But if we close our hearts to protect ourselves, to shield ourselves from the pain of our lives and our experiences, then we also inhibit our ability to receive and experience God's grace in the midst of our brokenness and our pain. So I'll return again to my own family. When my kid brother Jared was 20, he received this diagnosis that he had cancer, and the diagnosis was very positive. He had a 95% chance of survival. And Jared had been this, he was a brilliant and big-hearted kid. He was 10 years younger than me. But somewhere in his teen years, he became cynical and emotionally shut down even before his diagnosis. And so his early experience with cancer was really painful for us because Jared was just so shut down. And I remember we went out when I came home for a visit and we went out for drinks and he was with just a sibling, so four of us. And he said, you know, he says, if this really gets bad, I'm contemplating suicide. And it was a long and winding road, his six-year journey with cancer, filled with ups and downs. But in the final year of his life, I saw him transform. His body wasn't healed, but something happened in his soul. He fell in love with life. He found his heart again. And all of a sudden, this wisdom and this spirit beyond his years began to flow out of him. And there'd be times towards the end where I was having a conversation with him. And I would feel like, who is this guy and where is this coming from? And I felt ever since a strange kind of victory in his death, because he attained this depth and transparency of consciousness that I rarely see in people of any age. And I rejoice in that because Jared found his soul. He found his true self. And when you think about it, what else is there for us to do in these lives that we've been given? Right? We buy this story that the purpose of our lives is to string together all of these, you know, fascinating, exciting experiences, all of these things that make us comfortable. And we miss the real reason that we're here, which is to come profoundly awake to who we are and to somehow be able to access that, even in the midst of this roller coaster, which is our lives. Jared figured out how to do that. Now, as I reflected about these stories, you know, the Gospels tell us that these two were healed. But they don't tell us what happens after that, right? We don't know the rest of the story. We just know that they had an experience of God's incredible grace and healing and mercy. But as for the rest of the story, we just don't know. And so I love sort of the open-endedness of the Gospels, because it's always an invitation for us to reflect on our own lives. You know, so think about your own life. And we've all of us had experiences of grace and healing in some way or another. So the question is, what do we do with those experiences? And of course, we all have experiences of great suffering and loss. And what do we do with those experiences? What lies ahead of us on our journeys? So since I've talked so much about my family, I'm going to end with another story from my family. I had a recent conversation with my dad. I called him just, I think it was the Friday before Father's Day. We hadn't talked in a while. And it was a blessed conversation. My dad is 92 now. He and I are very different in temperament, in perspective. And so we do not always connect deeply. Sometimes we just sort of miss, you know, and it just has been, you know, our relationship. So we were just catching up on, you know, what had been going on. And I told him, of course, about the wisdom school that I had been to earlier in June in Stonington, Maine. And I was just trying to describe it to him, that it was filled with, you know, spiritual striving and practices, and that there was also this intention that those of us who were feeling called to this spiritual seeking and work would use it as a way of what it really wants us to do in this moment in time, which is for us somehow energetically begin to hold a space within ourselves for an intention of a healing of our deep divisions, which wound us all right now as a country. And that, you know, we're not that we're able to heal this, but somehow in our hearts, we're holding that intention and that energy, which is maybe an opening for the healing energies and mercy of God to move in ways that we can't see or control, but which is real, I believe. And I quoted to Dad the statement that I heard from Tim Shriver about our $4 trillion outrage industrial complex, which you know, is designed to keep us angry and fearful and divided. And as I shared that, I could, you know, how you can sense a shift in energy. And this, we weren't physically present. This is on the phone. Just, you can feel these subtle shifts in energy with a tone of voice or whatever. Look for those signals, right? And that's our work, is to shift our energy too. And in shifting our energy to help other people maybe to move into a different kind of energy. And so Dad began to speak about his own, you know, physical decline and limitations. He can't move around as well as he used to. Of course, he's 92 and has all kinds of aches and pains and all the rest. And then he just talked about his ever deepening trust in God. And I said, I'm with you, Dad. Meaning by that, but that's my deep intention too, to move to this ever deepening trust in God. But as I spoke the words, I instantly became aware of another connotation of what I'd just spoken. Just on its face, simply, I'm with you, Dad. And I think he heard that. So you never know when you're going to have your last conversation, right? You never know. It might be 10 years from now. It might be much sooner. But I know this. If that turned out to be the last conversation I ever had with my dad, I would feel complete, because something deeper than words was spoken and heard. And that's why Jesus wants us to have faith. For something deeper than words, deeper than we can know, is always present and always beckoning us to see and to know and to taste and to live. May it be so. Amen.